This is Billy Kay with the Scots Tongue for 1986. First though, a clip for a new 7th episode on the muckle change in attitude about Scots and skills. Diane Anderson for Morgan Academy, Dundee.
For a Scots speakers, it's acknowledging their home language. And when you dinna do that, a lot of them switch off at literacy learning altogether because they're told, no, it's wrong. So their natural enthusiasm for literacy, their natural ability is totally squashed, and some of them just switch right off. And I've seen it again and again. Bairns fa never volunteer onything in class. You do a Scots lesson and they're louping out their seats to tick peart. Now, the reality is now there's a lot of them that dinna hae that muckle Scots, but they're hearing it daily day and they love it. It's fun. So that aspect can engage a lot of them. And for bairns that have moved to the country recently, they want the cultural capital O'Kane in the Scots. So really it's win-win a-roon.
But for now, we'll learn who the Loss of Court and Parliament affected the status of Scots in Programme Fower, The Confusion of Union.
I think generally for the population, you definitely are judged in the way you speak. Because I mean, in a linguistics class, they did a kind of experiment with us that they let us listen to various accents, and we had to place that folk in certain jobs and say what age we thought they were and stuff like this. And you tended, in spite of yourself, even in spite of the language, in spite of kenning the prejudices, you tended to put the folk with the posh accents in the top jobs.
Meg Jukett, who studied Scots at Edinburgh University, reminding us that even people who know the pedigree of the Scots language are still affected by the long ascendancy of English. The origins of this attitude go back to the Reformation and the adoption by Scottish Protestants of a Bible written in English, not Scots. This process of anglicisation gathered pace with the union of the Scottish and English crowns in 1603 and the union of parliaments in 1707. But the prestige of English wasn't guaranteed by the English Bible. For a few generations after the Reformation, Scots continued as the language of the court. In fact, James VI was a devotee of literature in the native language, gathering around him a coterie of excellent poets who continued the work of the great medieval makers. James himself wrote a book called Rules and Cottles to be a Shuit in Scots Poesy, a kind of do-it-yourself guide to writing poetry in the Scots tradition. Here, he complained that none of the works previously published on the poet's craft were suitable for the Scots writer.
Never one of them written in our language. For albeit Sindri has written of it in English, whilk is likest to our language, yet we differ from them in Sindri rules of poesy, as you will fin by experience.
The Scottish court of James VI was the last to give its support to poetry written in Scots, so that when his court moved to London in 1603, another source of prestige for the language was gone, never to return. From being the sophisticated medium of court poets, Scots would slowly become associated only with folk poetry and music. The written language changed very quickly, especially as Scottish printers could suddenly reach a big market in England by anglicising their texts. James VI's book on royal statecraft, The Basilic in Doron, is a case in point. The original manuscript in Scots has phrases like "Takin nera tent gif," but in subsequent printed editions over a 10-year period, the language becomes more and more anglicised, becoming "Takin naro tent if," and finally "Taking good heed if." The poets who followed James to London also quickly realised on which side their bread was buttered. William Alexander, Earl of Stirling, in the introduction to his own collection of poetry, writes,
"The language of this poem is, as thou seest, mixed of the English and Scottish dialects, which perhaps may be unpleasant and irksome to some readers of both nations. But I hope the gentle and judicious English reader will bear with me if I retain some badge of mine own country, by using sometimes words that are peculiar thereunto, especially when I find them proper and significant. And as for my own countrymen, they may not justly find fault with me if, for the more part, I use the English phrase as worthy to be preferred before our own, for the elegance and perfection thereof.
Apologising for our native language, yet being proud of it as the language of our people, is an ambivalent attitude that's been around for a very long time. David Purvis of the Scots Language Society.
The problem of Scots is, of course, it's an educational problem. This is part of our heritage, this language, and it has become fragmented. There has been a tendency to teach it in the schools as if it were an incorrect form of English, or even a vulgar and coarse and uneducated way of speaking English. So our attitude to Scots has affected the whole psyche of the Scottish people. It has exacerbated the tendency they have had to have an inferiority complex ever since the time of the Treaty of Union. So I feel myself that the way that this language has been treated over successive generations has introduced a schizoid element into the Scottish psyche, which is not really realised. People feel that if the way of speech, which is natural to them, is downgraded and decried, it is an insult not only to them, but to their home family, to their parents and their grandparents who have spoken that way.
I mind when I get to Elgin Academy for Houtman, I get into this classroom, a chiel outside had asked me to find somebody in the class for him. And I get in and I said, there's a chiel out there, she could speak to you. And he just looked totally blank. He hadn't a clue what I was saying. And years later, he told me that he just didn't understand what I was saying. And he didn't even realise that a place like Houtman, just 7 miles from Elgin, that spoke that different. So I suppose you gather eventually through, you know, various incidents like that nobody speaks like you.
Who did Andy approach your dialect? What do you think of it?
Well, I think your first reaction is to be annoyed at the negative attitudes that come across. You know, like you're ignorant if you speak like that, or you're a yokel or something like this. But eventually you just have to realise that you have to communicate with other folk, and if maist folk gneps like that, you've to gnep by now.
What does gnepping mean?
To talk English. To talk posh. Or you might just say to talk.
Just a few miles away from Meg Jukett in Hopman is another fishing toon, Lossiemouth, which is a slightly different but just as rich Scots speech. When I spoke to Evelyn Crockett about her days at the herring gutting, she came away with phrases that could have come out of the classical Scots of the 15th century. No, for her, the English, we used to keep a few stones to frighten the seagulls away, but the Scots, we used to hain a puckle stains to flag away the gowse.
The fish acquaintance, as we were called, was not looked upon, and yet we would need it, and badly need it, were in trade. If it hadn't been for us, there'd be no use for the fishing. So we went to Lerwick. Now we had to walk 2 miles out to Grimmester. And when we arrived at Grimmester, the huts that were your until was full of bottles. First we had to do was empty the bottles out of the huts. Then we had to take a pail of water and scrub out the huts and make them livable. Mm. The curates were not caring, they would not care less. Oh, of course, mind you, we had good times on Lerwick and all. We used to travel that 12 mile to the dancing. And we danced all day, the dances with the Lerwick loons, and then we come home and learn the loons here.
If the Scots herring gutters were welcome in Shetland, their compatriots a few hundred years back didn't enjoy quite the same favour. After the control of Shetland was transferred from Norway to Scotland at the end of the 15th century, the ruling class in Shetland was Scots, and so was the language of prestige and power. The Shetland language, Norn, which was of Scandinavian origin, came under threat from Scots, in the same way as Scots later come under pressure from the all-conquering English. John Graham is editor of the Shetland Dictionary.
By the early 17th century, most of the kind of apparatus of power, the commerce and the law courts, kirk and school, all these were conducted in Scots English. And of course, the kirks were well organised by the 18th century. And of course, in the Presbyterian kirk, the Bible is the focal point of worship, and the Bible was in English. So inevitably, Scots English encroached more and more on the Shetland Norn. But it didn't kill it. The people became bilingual, and they were still speaking Norn until, I would say, around about 1750.
And how gradual was the takeover by the Scots language?
It's just gradually evolved over the years, so that I don't think that if you were to stop a Shetlander and ask him how much of his language was Norse, how much of it was Scots, he could tell you. It's just gradually moved from generation to generation, and it's the Scandinavian words which have tended to be eroded, because the media, education, newspapers, and all the rest of it. In fact, when you think of all these things ranged against the old Shetland dialect, mm-hmm. it's astonishing that Jacobson, the Faroese scholar, in the 1890s, he found actually 10,000 Norn words still being used. Mm-hmm. 10,000 words, which is a lot of words.
What is the linguistic reality about the dialect today? What percentage of it is Scots and what percentage Scandinavian?
Well, I was just, in fact, looking at this not so long ago, and I would say it's not more than 10% Scandinavian vocabulary. The rest is sort of a mixture of Scots and English.
Right.
English, you know, with a local pronunciation.
The island of Whalsey has one of the most distinctive of the Shetland dialects. Here's Harriet Sanderson and her friends at the Machan, or knitting.
Well, this is just the shops of Lerig at where Machan Tellin now. We get up their yarn and they send up the sample, and then we just copy them, and then we're just paid for what we're doing.
And do you normally do it in a group like this?
Well, yeah, this is where's heading was all the langer as we saw. About the nights. Mm-hmm. Well, how nights that we are up in Macapur socks, and then we might play a game of yogurt. Jerts, lay by with socks. We do that, and you fed up with our socks sometimes.
So is it half work and half social?
Yeah. But you never like to set you down without something in your hand to do. Yes, you are learned to tuck your sock if you set you down. You are learned to do that for your piri burns. So you feel kind of guilty if you set you down about the night with pepper. I mean, you feel fair happier when you have your sock.
That's true.
Shetlanders don't really think of their dialect as Scots. It's part of their Shetland identity. For a long time, the dialect was officially regarded with disdain, but fortunately, it survived strongly, and now, thanks to the like of John Graham, Rhoda Boulter and Mary Blance, it's an integral part of the local Radio Shetland output.
Tamar is this day again? I was never looking to see you any more this day.
Oh, never speak.
What's come at thee? Does awful kind of thirst up as if those a tell a tirt?
You can say him. I'm not a thin a very good lady night, I can tell you, or I would never have been for the sheik of the fire with sick and weather. But I hate to win for it and speak with something afore I just louse to Gibby and clear to Dix.
After the Official Education Act of 1872, then, you see, most of the teachers that came in were Scots or English, and they had no interest whatever. In fact, they were so strong on getting a common culture and a common sort of language that they actually, I can remember at school, that if we used a dialect word, you know, it was taboo, really. And because of that, and the fact that we were constantly being told to talk proper, that people began to think of the dialect as improper. If English was proper, then by definition, the Shetland dialect was improper. In fact, I'm a kind of product of that. I have this kind of almost inner compulsion to switch codes when I'm, say, I'm talking into a microphone, as I'm talking now.
Right.
If I'm talking to a fellow Shetlander, then I'll speak a kind of a Shetland dialect. So that the social aspect is very, very strong indeed, that the language was despised and people thought it was inferior, and because of that, they thought their own way of life was inferior, their culture was inferior, their homes were inferior. Well, that was strong in my day and earlier, but nowadays, the schools are paying a bit more attention to it. It's being used on our local radio, the dialect, quite a lot. And I think that its status is recently been, oddly enough, enhanced.
We anticipated what maybe 6 weeks or that this would run. What we had a written dialogue between two women.
Yeah.
We called ourselves Tamar and Binny. And I did it with Mary in the studio. And we deliberately used some of the lovely old words, the ones that were sort of sleeping soundly, waiting for the kiss of life, or Prince Charming to come along, or whatever, and reawakened them so that they could be used in everyday conversation. And we explained the meanings of the words before the programme got on, then we illustrated the words in context in this dialogue. And it was absolutely amazing, the response we got. The folk would come to us and say, we've never heard your word for long, and now we've started to use them again. All the various weather words. We got so many weather words. I mean, they're words, there's so many different degrees and density and mist and snow. You get flocra, that's what you call the pretty snowflakes coming down. You get scalva, that's large wet flakes. You get a murikavi, that's a dense snowstorm wee wind. You get a fogelkavi or a melimuri, that's when the particles of snow are so very fine that they're just like mist and they could suffocate you. You get lipet hail, where it comes down like half-boiled tapioca, you get it's wet hail. And you get sloppera, that's the slushy stuff, it just melts as it lands. You're going forever.
I wouldn't like to get caught in the snow in Shetland, if that's what I
see. The thing is, I think, you see, if everybody knew all the weather words, you could say a couple, and it would give you the locality, the density, and probably the duration, or how long it was likely to last.
Rhoda Boulter's list of words for different kinds of snow reminds us that every language has its own genius, which you can never translate directly. If the dialect is eroded, with it goes the kind of sensitivity to the physical environment that the dialect describes, and a unique world picture is then in danger, not just a language. Just as Scots infiltrated the Norn language of Shetland, so it also established itself as the language of colonial power in Ulster. The transfer of James VI's court to London was a blow to Scots, but James's plantation of Scottish colonists in Ulster west of the Bann resulted in the geographic spread of the language, as thousands of lowlanders established Scots communities from Derry to Donegal. North Down and Antrim weren't part of the official plantation, but they had attracted Scottish settlers since the 16th century, and today they retain the strongest elements of Scots speech. Ernie Scott from Ballinure, County Antrim.
Even the animals and the birds still use the Scots words for them and the country. Although the people who work in the town are becoming, these words are becoming less evident.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, we would still call Ka the curlew the whop.
Mm-hmm.
We would see the sheep still up on the nose, and we would be the same as yourselves are there. We would call them yows. We would talk about a heap of stains somewhere being a cairn. And, of course, we would also talk about somebody you couldn't get money out of, you couldn't tuck the breeks off a Highlander. Again, a word that has completely died out since I was a boy was as the word dicht, to dicht your nose. For instance, the word that we hear about here, and I'm sure you hear it across there, is the dipper. You'll get it. And are in Burns. And one of our poets said that the dipper peeks out for the fog at the brew and gives its neb a bit dicht and a stain. It's wiping its neb.
Most of the Ulster Scots came from the western counties of Scotland, and the folk from the North Antrim town of Bush Mills can look out to sea and make out the Ayrshire coast their ancestors left. In other parts of Ireland, they're still mistaken for their ancestors.
Funny Belfast, outside Belfast, Comber, the place I was, wife and me walking up and down the street, and we went into a record shop to buy a tape, and I says about the tape, I think it was an ABBA tape she wanted, and I says to her, the woman, could I have that ABBA tape? And she says, are you over here on holiday? And I sort of gave her a strange look and says, holiday? I says, she says, I think you're from Scotland. I says, I know, I'm not from Scotland. She says, I am from the north coast of Antrim. She says, very, very Scotch slang. She says, suppose that's the way we tap.
The dialect of Ulster, like all Scots, indeed all English dialects, came to be more and more looked down upon during the 18th century as the fashion for elegant Augustan English influenced literature and society. In Scotland, people were embarrassed by the so-called provincialism of their speech. In the period following the Union of Parliaments, many went all out to make themselves North Britons rather than Scots. Jack Aitken, editor of the Dictionary of the Older Scottish Tongue.
They were, as we would now say, linguistically insecure. They were very short of self-confidence in the English, which, in fact, by then they were speaking. It wasn't what the English would call pure English. It was near enough pure English. So they were aware that their English was somewhat lacking in propriety. Now, the term propriety belongs, of course, to the Augustan vogue of Dryden and Addison and Pope and so on in 18th century English, a vogue which condemned anything provincial, anything vulgar, anything different from the best standards as abhorrent. So it was necessary to speak and also write, of course, with propriety.
You know, I came to England the last time upon no other account but to learn the language, and promised to keep correspondence with you upon this condition, that you would make remarks upon my letters and faithfully admonish me of all the Scotticisms or all the words and phrases that are not current English therein. I confess I have a great veneration for our own and the Northern English language, upon the account of the Anglo-Saxon, to which they are so nearly allied, but yet am as ambitious to write modern English as any Gascon or Provençal can be to write the modern French.
That letter was written at the end of the 17th century. Its analogy between Scots and Provençal is apt. Both were great medieval languages, which lost ground to the cultures of the nation-states that absorbed them, France and Britain. For many Scots in the 18th century, though, the English influence was one of degree. Alan Ramsay did sterling patriotic work in the years following 1707, republishing classical Scots poetry and collecting Scots songs. Yet, he was a product of the age, and could balance a love of Scots and pro-Jacobite leanings with a reverence for the English of writers like Pope and Addison. Ramsay and his friends used to read The Spectator aloud to each other in order to improve their English. The Augustan influence comes out in some of Ramsay's poetry.
Young Philander wooed me lang, but I was peevish and forbade him. I wadna tent his loving sang, but noo I wish I had him. Ilk morning when I view my glass, then I perceive my beauty going. And when the wrinkles seize the face, then we may bid adieu to wooing. My beauty, yin so much admired, I find it fading fast and fleeing. My cheeks, which coral-like appeared, grow pale, the broken blood decaying. Ah, we may see ourselves to be like summer fruit that is unshaken, when ripe, they soon fall doon and dee, and by corruption quickly taken.
Ramsay's Augustan style, with a sprinkling of Scots, but mainly using English to suit the high moral tone of the piece. When the poet uses his full Scots style, it's much more vigorous and racy, but it reflects the diminished social status of Scots in the 18th century. Many of Ramsay's best Scots poems refer to low life in the city, like this deathbed advice from an Edinburgh brothel keeper, Lucky Spence.
Three times the carlin graint and rift it, then frae the cod her pow she lift it, in body policy weel gifted, when she knew fan that death nae langer would be shifted, she thus began. "Ma lovin' lasses, I'm on leave ye, but dinna wi' your greetin' grieve me, nor wi' your draunts and dronin' deave me, but brings a Jill. For faith, ma bairns, ye may believe me, 'tis gainst ma will. Oh, black-eyed Bess and mim-mood Meg, our good to work or yet to beg, lay sunkets up for a sair leg. For when ye fail, your face will no be worth a fag, nor yet your tail. Cleek all ye can by hook or crook, ripe ilka pooch frae nuke to nuke, be sure to truff his pocket-book. 60 pound Scots is nae deef nits, in little book lie great bank-notes. To get amends, o whingin' fills, that's frichted for repentance stills, wha often, when their metal cools, turns sweer to pay, gar the kirk boxy hail the duels another day."
Ramsay's changes of literary style in the 18th century are changing all the time from Scots to English speech today. They're related, even though separated by 250 years. Adapting our language to suit the formality of the situation is second nature to us. Mostly, we're unaware we do it. When we are aware of it, we often get in a fankle because we're mair at hame in the tongue we learnt from our mithers. Back in Ulster, Lil MacKillop has a typically Scottish experience living in Ireland. She has to adapt her Antrim tongue for the benefit of the outsiders she shows round the distillery at Bushmills.
"Because English people and American people just wouldn't understand me at all. They wouldn't have a clue. If I was to go the way I normally talk, so I have to polish it slightly. So when they come in, I am very la-di-da and proper. And when the Scottish people are about, I just talk perfectly normally. But I do have lapses."
"Aye."
"And then, of course, when you have a lapse, the first thing the Americans are going to say to you is, 'What's a nice Scottish girl like you doing in an Irish distillery?' And then, of course, that all starts the whole thing off.
About the Scots and the Irish.
About the Scots and the Irish again.
And do you find it hard to stay solidly English all the time?
Very, very, very difficult.
Do folk ever put their foot in it?
Oh, well, I'm very good at it. You know, such as being very polite and saying, 'Oh, you put out the cups and saucers and I'll butter the bread.' I mean, that just drops you right in it, up to the oxters."